You're listening to Getting Lit with Linda Mora, the podcast where we welcome you to get lit. Canadian lit, that is. Join Linda as she talks about authors in Canada and sometimes with them, using her expertise to shed some light on recent and not so recent writers. And now, get ready for Getting Lit with Linda.
Hi, this is Linda Mora, the writer and host of Getting Lit with Linda. I have a special guest with me today, a Montreal-based freelance writer, editor, and content producer whose work has appeared in The Guardian, The Atlantic, Maclean's, The Walrus, The Globe and Mail, and many other publications. Here she is, reading an excerpt from her book.
Have you ever been told the pain you feel is imaginary? That the mental anguish you experience from being trapped in a cycle of feeling bad and then feeling bad about feeling bad could be solved with a better attitude and a brisk walk? Or have you tried yoga, meditation, eating probiotic yogurt, drinking unicorn blood on a full moon? Perhaps you just need to get off your phone, get out into nature, get into woodworking, go on a vision quest, maybe learn to crochet or take up archery or create YouTube makeup tutorials. I hear Kegels help. Get that pelvic floor into fighting shape. When you have an invisible disease like endometriosis, you hear versions of this all the time.
That was Tracy Lindemann reading from Bleed, Destroying Myths and Misogyny in Endometriosis Care. Tracy, I am so, so grateful for you for this book. I'm an endo patient and I recognized and experienced the pain that you described in this book. I raged, I wept when I was reading it. I felt the frustration with the gaslighting of the medical system and so on. I just want to say thank you so much for your courage and vulnerability, for giving us this book, which is long past due. We really needed a book like this.
I'm glad that you feel seen, but also sad that you feel seen.
Well, before we even talk about visibility and invisibility, thank you also for being with me on the show and talking about this, for Getting Lit with Linda. I really appreciate it a great deal. Thank you.
My pleasure. Yeah.
There's a lot that you've packed into the 9 chapters of this book. And Bleed for me is not just about endometriosis. It was also about the medical system. So many of our listeners won't even know what endometriosis is. I'm wondering if you could begin with a definition of that and then we can continue on with the discussion of your book.
Yep. So endometriosis is a profusely painful condition experienced by 10% of people assigned female at birth, or as I like to say, 5% of the entire global population. It is characterized by the growth of endometrial-like tissue outside of the uterus. And the growths are called lesions, adhesions, endometriomas. And they attach to the outside of your uterus. They attach to your ovaries, often the bowel. You know, some people get it on their bladders, their ureters, their kidneys, their diaphragms, their lungs, their brains, their skin. I saw today it can even be in your nose. And so it can grow all throughout your body. And it is grossly misunderstood, often misdiagnosed, and yet is so extremely common.
Well, as I say, it was also part of my own experience. I absolutely hate it when people wrongly assume that it's just a bad period. It's essentially a kind of autoimmune disorder. And so I think it's grossly misunderstood.
Yeah. There is some thinking, some research that suggests that there is some autoimmune aspect to it. It is not classified as an autoimmune disease like lupus is, but it is also quite common for people with endo to have autoimmune diseases like lupus. And so, you know, the science is still working on that, but I think that those are really interesting ties to think about when we think about endo.
Well, that's it. There are so many theories that you were exploring in the book, theories I myself have heard my entire life. Okay, so is it or is it not an autoimmune disorder? And can we associate it with childhood abuse or not? And what kind of woman does it, it's not only women, but what kind of women does it affect and so on? And there are all of these theories that have spun out, but without any really clear or solid research to substantiate many of those theories because it's not really attended to in the medical system, which is why in part your book is also about the medical system. So that's the other half of the book. I wonder if you might speak to the listeners about why it is that you're addressing the medical system.
Well, I think even if we don't know how it starts or even necessarily how it spreads, the fact is that people are living with this. And so it's great that the scientific research community is continuing to investigate what causes it. But we also need to treat people right now.
Hear, hear.
We have, yeah, like the definition of endo kind of came about 100 years ago, and not much has changed since then. Endo is as old as people are, as old as time. And there's still so much misunderstanding in society about this disease. And why is that? Why don't we understand endo? And it's not just because it's so enigmatic that it can't possibly be understood. It's that maybe there's not a lot of volition to understand it because it is a women's disease, right? Because, you know, and I say that in quotes, because it also is experienced by, you know, trans and non-binary people, and also in some cases, cis men who are assigned male at birth. But it's still overwhelmingly considered a female disease. And often people with this disease who are not women are still treated as kind of women adjacent, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the book is talking about the systemic forms of discrimination that go into the care that we receive. And I thought it was really important to think of it as to look at it from a systems approach. Because frankly, like most endo literature just doesn't go there. It's treated as an individualized or personalized problem, that it's just up to you to help yourself, to fix yourself, to deal with your own pain. And yet we let the systems off the hook for continuing to misdiagnose us, failing to treat us. And I think it's about time that we think about why we're not being cared for.
Well, to belittle us as well. I thought it was interesting that the term that you used frequently throughout the book was gaslighting, which had never occurred to me to think of it that way before until I read your book. And I thought, I remembered my very first encounter with a medical doctor who told me that my pain was just that of a bad period and told me to essentially to suck it up and prescribed a medication that had worse side effects in some ways than the actual pain that I was enduring, or it complicated, it made it much worse. It didn't help at all. And so I thought I was being gaslit. She was telling me that my pain wasn't real.
Yeah. And I think gaslighting is a term that a lot of armchair philosophers on the internet say, like, it's being misused or overused. And it is in a lot of ways. Gaslighting was coined to refer to instances in intimate partner violence in which the violence that typically a woman, but a partner in the relationship, endures is because they did something to deserve it. I'm just going to read a little part from the book with respect to gaslighting. In circumstances outside of medicine, such as in intimate relationships, gaslighting is rightfully recognized as emotional abuse. In a 2019 American Sociological Review article, sociologist Paige L. Sweet theorizes that gaslighting is effective when it is rooted in social inequalities, especially gender and sexuality, and executed in power-laden intimate relationships. When perpetrators mobilize gender-based stereotypes, structural inequalities, and institutional vulnerabilities against victims with whom they are in an intimate relationship, gaslighting becomes not only effective, but devastating. Not only is a gaslightee emotionally abused and manipulated within the relationship, but the gaslighter also often succeeds in telling people around the woman, and it is almost always a woman, that she's just a crazy bitch. And that really speaks to my own experience, and I guess yours too, and a lot of other people's, in that you're told too. That, have you considered that you're just crazy instead of actually in pain? When you hear that for years and years and years, it often makes you question your own lived reality. Like, is this actually happening, or am I making it happen?
Exactly. Tracy, there were moments when I was taken off on a stretcher to the hospital because I had passed out from the pain. And I think, how in the world can I be making this up? And yet, that's the abusive part that your book so effectively delineates, this kind of dismissal, this constant dismissal, that pain can't be that bad. You're making that up. So then you draw upon both anecdotes and research. And I found that the book balances these two things extremely well. So you interview people who have actually had endometriosis or have it now, and then you do this kind of background research. So one of the stories was about the tests on mice and how they discovered that actually the medication that they were using wasn't as effective on female mice as it was on male mice, demonstrating that the very medications we take are not as effective for us as they are for those who are
male. Yeah.
So there was that component, but then there was also the component or the stories that you were interweaving. And the one that comes to mind is of the woman who had had children, who had experienced childbirth, and then said that pain was nothing compared to the pain of endometriosis. Listen, I leapt out of my chair. I've always thought that. I've never had children, but the pain was so agonizing. I thought it cannot be that childbirth is worse than this, certainly.
Yeah. I mean, and she isn't the only one who said that. You know, other people have said it to me and, you know, in other places in the public realm. And it may not be the case for everybody. For some people, maybe childbirth is more agonizing, but we can't discount the fact that some people say it is just as or more painful than giving birth. And yet we're expected to just grin and bear it. We're expected to just take two Advil and don't call me in the morning. We're just expected to go to work, go to school, perform as usual, despite all of this pain. Like, why is that considered fair in this society?
Exactly. It's almost self-evident now. I want to know why you wrote this book, what compelled you to do it. It almost seems self-evident. But let me ask you, why do you think you wrote this book?
So I've been a freelance journalist for almost 20 years, and I never wrote about health. And I certainly never wrote about my own health. And it was as if my journalism career and my health were on two separate tracks. And my journalism career, for better and worse, helped me suppress the part of myself that was suffering, because I always dealt with my own pain and experiences by overworking, by working really hard, by just ignoring how I was feeling. And
I'm so sorry.
There came a point where I was kind of like, I can't ignore that this is actually a story. And that was informed by a couple different things. One was that I finally got diagnosed. And so it wasn't just like an endless tale of suffering. Like, there was actually like something that happened, like a pivotal moment. And so then I was like, okay, maybe there's more to this story than just I'm in pain. Somebody listen to me. Yeah. And also, I think my own understanding of intersectional feminism needed to evolve and come to a place where I could think about these issues more critically than just, we are in pain, it's because we're women, let's, you know, like, it made my viewpoint more mature, more sophisticated, more inclusive. And yeah, and I think that that's really what was needed, because the vast majority of literature on endo, whether it's books, magazine articles, scientific literature, is exclusionary to the vast majority of people. Mm-hmm. You only ever really hear, when you read like a scientific study about endo, and you think about who's in the study, it's almost always thin white women.
Yes. This in the book. Yes.
Yeah. And there are so many reasons why that isn't enough. But no one's ever really publicly challenged that before. And I was like, well, this is obviously a place that needs some work in our, you know, a conversation about endo.
And you've started that crucial work, or you've done two things. You've laid a foundation for further work, but I also feel like you threw down a gauntlet for the medical system and said, this is insufficient. Mm-hmm. we can do better. We need to do better.
Yeah.
Because there are millions of people who are suffering, and it's dismissed as if it were nothing, unless, of course, you want to bear a child, which is another part of the book. Did you want to speak a little bit about that?
Well, just so that listeners are aware, I never wanted kids. And so to me, it seemed like an obvious solution to just have a hysterectomy, because at the time, I only thought I had endo. I had not been diagnosed, but I was like pretty sure I had endo. I had never heard of adenomyosis, which I ultimately was also diagnosed as having. And that's when the endometrium grows into the muscles of your uterine wall. And it's also extremely painful and also extremely common. And so I had both. But at the time, you know, when I decided to go off the pill because it was making me feel crazy, I was just like, take it out. I mean, I don't want kids and I don't want a period. How about we kill two birds with one stone? And my doctor at the time, and, you know, she wasn't the only one, but she was definitely one of the people standing in the way in a lot of ways, was, you're going to change your mind. And she, even during this conversation, when I was like, I just want a hysterectomy. And she's like, well, you know, pregnancy is a cure for endo. And after writing this book, I've just heard from so many people who've been told that very same thing, which ignores the very real reality that most people with endo struggle with infertility. So even if you do want kids, it is extremely hard to conceive, often for people with endo. And so just this like, oh, we'll just get pregnant, that'll solve the problem. I was like, number one, I don't want kids. Number two, that's assuming I could even get pregnant.
Exactly.
And so even if I did succeed in getting pregnant, what was I going to do with a baby? Throw it in the garbage? I'm like, you've served your purpose. Like, no, I can't do that, you know? And so like, it just felt like, how could you, someone who barely really knows me, make a decision affecting the entire course of my future and deprive me, someone who's known themselves for their entire life, the agency to make a choice like that? And I can make so many decisions for myself that could possibly lead to death or dismemberment. I could go skydiving, I could jump off a building, a bungee cord and it snaps. I could get my whole face reconfigured at a plastic surgeon's office. I could get my entire body tattooed. I could get my tongue split in half, be like a serpent through body modification. I could do all of these things by signing a waiver and saying, I do not hold you responsible. And yet I couldn't make a decision about my uterus. I was just prohibited from making any such decision. And I think that we really need to think hard about why that is. Why do we prevent people from making these kinds of decisions?
Wow, I felt such a, as you were describing this, the contrast between the things that we can do and that we yet we can't make this decision, is that's amazing to me. Of course, that also comes out in the book, but for some reason, you really heightened it here. I really feel that.
Yeah. And it's a question that doesn't really have a real answer, because the answer is misogyny, capitalism, racism, discrimination. And those are huge, huge problems in our society that people in power are not likely to give up, right?
Not likely, no.
And so why can't I make this choice? And then just not having a satisfying answer to that question is very frustrating.
Tracy, have you had a lot of people reach out to you since you've written this book? Are there a lot of endo patients who have tried to reach out to you?
Oh yeah, for sure. The Instagram for the book, which is just bleed_the book, has been a lightning rod for people kind of coming to me and being like, oh my God, thank you so much. I finally feel seen. I feel understood. I've never seen myself reflected so accurately. It's been really great to see how it's been received. Not everyone, I think, feels accurately represented. For example, at my Toronto event, somebody interrupted to say that they had had a great experience with Lupron. Wow. But I think that the vast majority of people who have played with Lupron feel as though they played with fire. But that's a whole different conversation. But I mean, I can't represent everybody, but I think that I represented a lot more people than who are accustomed to being represented. And that matters a lot. And I'm glad to know that it's being perceived in this way.
It really didn't matter to me whether or not our experiences perfectly coincided. What made me so happy about reading this book, if one could ever feel happy about talking about endometriosis at all, was that someone was speaking about it. Someone was recognizing that it was like holding up a mirror. Yes, I had this conversation with this medical doctor. Yes, I tried Lupron and that really wasn't a cakewalk for me. I ended up, by the way, taking Toradol, which eventually damages your liver and your eyesight, both of which have happened with me, but I could live with the pain, therefore. But I was reading the account thinking, okay, it didn't exactly happen that way for me, but I don't care because someone is openly talking about this and drawing attention to the issue. So I think that to me was key.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like it's impossible to 100% identify with every single aspect of another person's lived experience, exactly. But you don't need to identify 100% to see yourself in the struggle and to identify with the struggle and to feel as though we all need to be demanding better.
Yes, I think we do. It's hard to understand the legacy of this disease because, as you yourself say on page 37, quote, many of us remain high functioning in spite of our pain. So in a way, it's like an invisible disease. We're not in any way looking like it's debilitating when it is. So what advice would you give now to doctors who are treating patients, who are treating endo patients?
Number one, believe your patients. When they say they're struggling, when they're in pain, when they can't do X, Y, Z, believe them. What do you have to lose by believing them? You have nothing to lose. Number two is that you need to read up on what excision specialists say is the best course of action for people with endometriosis. There are a lot of generalist OB-GYNs who do not understand how to perform proper surgery. Referring your patients to a generalist OBGYN is not always going to help them. Mm-hmm. So you have to stay open-minded and stay curious about your patient's experience. Collaborating with your patient, not just prescribing the medication, actually listening to what they want to do and helping facilitate that is hugely important because you may be their doctor, but this is their life. This is what they have to live with every second of every minute of every day of their lives. And so what do you have to lose by working with your doctors? And admit to what you don't know. It's okay to not have every answer. It's okay to not know what to do. You can tell your patient, I don't actually know what we should do here, but let me talk to some colleagues. Let me do a little bit of research and I'll get back to you. It's totally fine to do that. I would rather you admit you not know than you trying out a bunch of random stuff on me.
Exactly.
Honestly.
Exactly.
And so those are things, those are real tangible things that doctors can do right now. It doesn't take hardly any more time. It does take more compassion, but very little effort in the grand scheme of things. And you can make a huge difference in your patient's life by doing these things.
Thank you. And now for those who have never experienced this, but know someone who has it, what would you recommend that they do to show support?
Everyone knows somebody with endo. You may not know that they have endo. They may not know that they have endo, but you probably know somebody, or you have known at least one person in your life who is struggling with this kind of intense, acute, chronic pain. What you can do is believe them. Do not minimize their pain. Do not try to compare it to your own pain. Don't ask them to put it on a scale of 1 to 10. Ask them what the experience is. What can you and can't you do because of your pain? Or you can just bring them snacks, get them a gift card for a massage, be a nice friend who listens to them when they say, I just need to vent, and to not try to give them solutions. Have you tried this? Have you tried that? Because chances are they have tried that and more. They do not need your advice. What they need is a friend who can exhibit empathy and compassion and snacks.
Not unicorn's blood.
I should start a snack company called Unicorn Blood.
I think that would work well.
I think it's just a thing that anybody who doesn't have like a chronic pain condition, like they just are so uncomfortable with someone talking about pain, and they feel powerless to help you because there really is nothing they can do to help you.
No, there isn't.
But they feel like the impetus to try and offer some kind of solace or help. Like, honestly, all it takes is just like, I'm so sorry for what you're going through. Is there anything I can do to help you right now? Often I find, not just with chronic pain, but also with grief, if you lose somebody in your life, a lot of people will say, let me know if you need anything. And it bothers me when people say that, because it puts the onus on the person who is suffering.
You got it.
What can I do for you? Or just assuming that they need a little treat, some care, a movie, like take them to a movie, bring them something, like bring them a casserole, just texting to be like, hey, how you doing? There are so many things that don't have to cost any money at all. Take them out for a picnic, go on a bike ride together. Like, exactly. There are so many things that you can do to be there for a person that is really not hard, but we are so uncomfortable thinking and talking to people about pain that we just feel like stymied by it. And it's such a, I don't know what to do. Therefore, I'm going to give you some really bad advice. And then I'm going to walk away slowly back out of the room.
Well, I think that's it. I think that you're right. Your book really centers on pain.
Mm-hmm. But also grief. Like what we lose by being robbed of agency, of futures, of ambitions, of the things that we would like to do that we can't physically do because we're in pain. That's real grief too. Grief doesn't only happen when you lose a person. It's like you're also losing yourself in a way. And it's a slow like realization process.
Yes. You're making me cry.
We're both crying. It's okay.
So I suppose then I should ask, what would you recommend to endo patients?
It's so frustrating being in Quebec and being in Canada because there aren't a lot of good options for care here. If you have the resources, my advice is to leave the country for care.
Oh, wow.
Is because you can't self-refer to surgeons in Canada. You have to beg people to refer you to the right person. And there are not a lot of right people in Canada who can do this kind of surgery. If you have the resources, you can self-refer to other places. You can call up a clinic in Romania or in Mexico or even the US and say, I have endo and I need surgery. And they say, come on down. And it cuts out years of gaslighting and abuse and discrimination and suffering. And we have to acknowledge the privilege that it takes to be able to afford that kind of thing. And I will say also that patients in Canada who have gone outside of the country for care report facing backlash from their doctors when they return, because who are you to make such a decision for yourself?
Yeah,
but ultimately, you're the one who matters most. Your health matters most in this situation. And so you do what you need to do. And that it's as simple as that. Your doctor, they may not take it well, but to live without pain and without the frustration and trauma of being gaslit constantly, it matters. your life matters. And so you really need to do what's best for you. In terms of what you can do if you do not have the resources, is do your research, know what kind of care is accessible to you, and push and push and push and push. And like, we're also used to pushing, but you have to push to get access to that kind of care if you hope to resolve your pain. And you need an excision specialist. If you want surgery, you need an excision specialist, not someone who's going to do a partial surgery, not somebody who's going to ablate or cauterize your disease. You need somebody who's willing to listen to you and to work with you to come up with the best treatment plan possible for you, and not just over rely on pharmaceutical drugs that come with a whole host of side effects for most people.
Oh, yeah.
And so it's exhausting to push, though. And that's why it took me so long to get diagnosed, because there were whole years of my life where I was just like, I don't care anymore. I don't want this disease to define the rest of my life. And also, I don't want to go through another ultrasound. I don't want to go through another round of medication right now.
Yeah.
And so it delayed my diagnosis significantly, because I just wasn't constantly grinding. But I needed those breaks to take care of myself in a lot of ways, you know, because it's hard work and it's exhausting kind of being like a professional patient. And if you can, if you have the energy and the mental abilities to do this, stand up to your doctors.
Hear, hear.
It's extremely intimidating to try to talk to doctors, especially because the power dynamic is set so early on in your relationship, especially if they have to perform any kind of internal exam where you feel very vulnerable and very powerless in those moments. But pushing back and being like, no, this isn't enough. This isn't what I need. I need this. It's not easy, and you may not make friends with your doctor that way. But again, it's your life. It's your life. And they have hundreds of patients, but you have one life. And so do what you need to do to live it.
Tracy, thank you for your compassion and your courage and your care. There are going to be so many people who are so grateful. I am so grateful to you for this book, for the research that you put into it, and for all your vulnerability in writing it. Thank you so, so much.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that was my interview with Tracy Lindemann in discussion about her new book, Bleed, published by ECW Press. If you like our episodes, please subscribe on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to join us for the next episode, released on June 15th, when I interview the East Coast novelist and short story writer, Lisa Moore. Thanks as always for listening, my dear listeners.
That was Getting Lit with Linda, hosted by Linda Mora. If you have a topic you would like to hear covered, write to us at gettinglitwithlinda@gmail.com. Until next time, we hope you continue to get lit.